From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. You could probably guess from the political ads in your feed, you're under the microscope this election year.
Well, Michigan is obviously a very interesting and important example. In order to win the White House, a Democrat is almost going to win Michigan in a general election.
It may be the state also has a key role in the rift developing among labor unions. This hour, we'll talk about how that's playing out in an already divided primary. Also on the show, Michigan Radio starts a new reporting project focused on one specific congressional district where Republicans are trying to hold on to gains from 2016.
Support President Trump, support President Trump, and then finally support President Trump.
And Lester Graham gives us a taste of the best from New Holland, not just about beer. It's also a distiller, too. All that and more coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Thanks for being with us today. On the show, our Friday News Roundtable is going to tackle the comments section of online publications, plus a survey of the Democratic candidates for president in Michigan ahead of primary elections. But first, Medicare for All took second place to the interpersonal dust-ups at the Democratic debate on Wednesday, but it's still a very prominent issue for many voters and a subject that candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are discussing frequently on the campaign trail. But a rift is developing within labor unions over Medicare for All. This is definitely one to keep an eye on as primary momentum shifts toward Michigan. Ian Colgren is a reporter on Politico's employment and immigration team, and he's been writing about this recently. Ian, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Labor unions regularly go to the mat for health coverage for their members. Why is Medicare for All a controversial issue with some of them?
Right. Well, I think to really understand this, let's start with what Medicare for All is, because when we watch things like the debate, there are a lot of claims thrown around about the various plans. But essentially, what it means in concept is getting rid of private insurance and changing healthcare into a government program. That is especially acute for labor unions across the country who have spent decades and decades negotiating for healthcare among their members. And there's an increasing worry among some of them, including most recently the Culinary Union in Las Vegas, that whatever the new government program is will not be as good as the deal that they've negotiated for their members.
Is that where you first saw this issue surfacing? Was in Nevada?
It's one that's been bubbling up time and time again throughout the course of the campaign so far. Frankly, some of the earliest debates when Tim Ryan was on stage, we heard him, we heard other candidates talk about this. This instance, though, is the most acute example yet of an on-the-ground union in an early primary state really making an issue out of this and marshaling their members to a specific point of view and, in effect, to a specific candidate or a specific set of candidates.
Right. The Culinary Workers Union declined to endorse any of the Democrats in the Nevada caucuses and have just been slamming Bernie Sanders' version of Medicare for All as a threat to the health plans that they've worked so hard to get. But you have talked to some unions who think that Medicare for All is a good idea, right?
That's true. There is certainly a divide among unions over whether Medicare for All is a good idea. In the one camp, you have folks like the culinary workers who really have one of the best health plans of any union in the country, saying that they don't want to lose their health care. And in the other camp, you have folks like the American Federation of Teachers, for example, which has endorsed both a public option and Medicare for All, saying that a government-run program would get it off the bargaining table and would allow them to focus their firepower on wages and other benefits for their workers.
When you were reporting this, did you get any sense of where major players in Michigan stand? I know that a lot of the early conversations about this have been in some other states, but what did you learn?
Well, Michigan is obviously a very interesting and important example of this debate because in order to win the White House, a Democrat is almost going to win Michigan in a general election. And although there's not an especially active or open upfront conversation about it right now, all of the pieces are there for this to be a big issue in the Michigan primary and beyond. The polling shows that a strong majority, as high as almost 60%, about 58% of strong, likely Democratic voters in Michigan support Medicare for All. But it's decidedly not as popular among the general electorate. And so any Democrat who really comes in and embraces Medicare for All in the primary could threaten alienating some of those swing voters, especially you think about, you know, the Macomb County voters that folks talk about all the time. A candidate certainly risks alienating some of those on-the-fence voters in the general by going hard at Medicare for All in Michigan.
I guess it's worth noting, too, that Bernie Sanders, who is arguably the strongest supporter of Medicare for All, really performed a big upset beating Hillary Clinton in 2016 in Michigan. So it's at least maybe one possible indicator that the issue is going to get some play as Michigan voters are deciding. Can you tell if the candidates are starting to react to this dispute? Have you heard any language or seen any subtle changes in their positioning on the policy that might indicate that they're paying attention to what union members on either side are concerned about?
Well, I think describing the candidates' positioning on this as subtle would be a massive understatement. A great example is Pete Buttigieg, who in the debate on Wednesday went really hard at the candidates who support Medicare for All, saying that the rhetoric surrounding the conversation is condescending, that they don't trust union members to make their own decisions about their own health care plan. I mean, it was a full frontal attack. And that's only going to get more intense in states like Michigan, where this issue really matters and different candidates are going to be competing for different slices of the electorate in order to cobble together a plurality to win a primary.
Ian, as the story notes, there are a couple of pretty high-ranking folks in Michigan who have ties to the health insurance industry. What did you find Michigan politicians saying about the whole rift?
The interesting thing is that a lot of union leaders in Michigan so far have remained mostly silent on this issue and haven't been nearly as vocal about it as, for example, the Culinary Union in Nevada has. As far as Michigan politicians go, there are some interesting fault lines at play, in part because a lot of the local union leaders in Michigan serve on the board of Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is something that single-payer advocates, another name for Medicare for All, point out as a reason why unions might not be eager to get on board with this. There's also the governor herself, Gretchen Whitmer, who has deep ties to healthcare. Her father, Richard Whitmer, was the president and CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield for a very long time. Blue Cross Blue Shield was among the top donors to her campaign as governor and also some of her other PACs in the legislature. And for that, I have to give a shout out to the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, which is a wonderful resource for anyone looking to see how interests are influencing state leaders. And as a result, she has had a really kind of complicated stance on this issue. In 2018, in the primary, she ran against opponents who supported Medicare for All. She did not support it at that time. She since drifted a little bit to the left on it. She said that she supports Medicare for All in concept, but hasn't really given a detailed explanation of what that means. So if you look at her position alone, she's sort of riding this center line that's difficult for politicians that we talked about earlier, where it might please some primary voters, but might not be the wisest bet in a general election. And that is a bet that Gretchen Whitmer already made when she ran for governor and won because she didn't pivot to the left. So if we want to talk about Michigan reflecting the presidential race as a whole, there's an argument to be made that it would be wise for some of these candidates like Pete Buttigieg to stay on a general election path, fight their way through the primary, scrap it out with Bernie Sanders, and then try to appeal to a wider swath of voters in the general.
As I was reading your story, I just kept thinking about the time when then-President Obama's healthcare plan was under construction, when the country was talking about all kinds of big changes with American healthcare, everything from how doctors get paid to really big structural issues about insurance, with an acknowledgement that the current system is not sustainable. What a long way we've come. What do you think happened between then and now?
Well, certainly Bernie Sanders as a person is one. We've seen him embrace this issue, get out in front of it. And this follows really the trajectory of our politics being more divided in general and the left moving further to the left and the right moving further to the right. There's also the practical element of this too, which is that healthcare costs just keep going up. And it's something that voters really deal with in their everyday lives. And it's something that people are just really concerned about and thinking about. And it's something that, you know, that's true among both union members and non-union members. To give you an idea of the divide with that, though, and why unions are so concerned about it, it's important to understand that, for example, in the recent UAW contract, UAW members pay about 3% of their overall healthcare costs. On average, Americans who are non-unionized overall workers pay about 29% of their healthcare costs. And so really where the rubber meets the road with this Medicare for All debate is the question of whether eliminating these premiums and raising taxes will ultimately both save Americans money and also give them better health care. And that is really what this debate's about.
Ian Colgren reports for Politico's employment and immigration team. His story about the rift among labor unions with respect to Medicare for All can be found. We've got a link on today's show page. Ian, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Still to come, a new political reporting project from Michigan Radio is going to take you right into the lives of voters, their worlds, and their beliefs in Michigan's 8th Congressional District.
It went for Trump in 2016. It's traditionally a pretty conservative district. And then in 2018, it flipped. It went for Democrat Alyssa Slotkin. And going into 2020, it's truly going to be a really competitive race.
Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer.
Thank you to the incredible people of Michigan.
President Trump won the state by fewer than 11,000 votes in 2016.
Listen, if these allegations are true, these are impeachable offenses.
I think most people are for Trump. That's what I think. I could be wrong.
I need to get out on November 3rd and get rid of him.
The path to the White House goes through Michigan. Huge state in 2020. Unavoidable, really. You think you're seeing a lot of ads now? Buckle up, my friend. It is way worse if you live in Michigan's 8th District. A pure toss-up going into 2020. Michigan Radio is taking on a new reporting and podcast project on the 8th. The people doing this reporting are Michigan Radio's own Kate Wells and Tyler Scott. Kate, Tyler, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, April.
Good to be here.
Tell us about this district. What's going on? Why the 8th?
Oh, my God. It's only February, and it's already crazy. Tyler and I were just talking about how we feel like we've aged 25 years. I cannot imagine what it's going to be like in the run-up through November. But we wanted, like you said, to spend a lot of time here because this is this one pure toss-up race.
The unicorn.
The unicorn that you almost never have anymore because districts are so polarized. It went for Trump in 2016. It's traditionally a pretty conservative district. And then in 2018, it flipped. It went for Democrat Alyssa Slotkin. You've probably seen on the news. And going into 2020, it's truly going to be a really competitive race. Both parties are going to be pouring a ton of money into here.
And geographically, sort of culturally, it's an interesting microcosm of a lot of different areas in Michigan. It splits into three counties that are three sort of distinct, characteristically different parts. In Ingham County, Lansing,
MSU.
East Lansing, Michigan State University, pretty solidly Democratic politically in terms of votes. Livingston County, more rural, smaller towns like Howell and Brighton, and just a lot of very rural areas. And in North
Major
Oakland
MAGA
County,
country, major what we should say about Livingston.
Very red.
Hardcore.
Mm-hmm. And North Oakland County, just this chunk of North Oakland County, is sort of more on the edge of the Detroit metro suburbs, getting into more ex-urban area. Traditionally conservative, Slotkin picked up a few votes in 2018 in some areas like Rochester, Rochester Hills, and she's from Holly, which is in North Oakland. But that area in North Oakland County is going to be very contested in 2020.
It's just a mix. So what are you guys trying to find out? What questions do you hope to answer with this project on the 8th?
Well, I mean, we all know with 2016, it feels like all the pollsters and the pundits, a lot of them at least, like really screwed this up. It feels like they missed something fundamental that was happening in this country. And we thought, what if you just, rather than just focus on these candidates and the campaigns, what if instead you just focus primarily on these voters? What do they believe? What is driving them? What are they seeing in terms of what news they're getting? What's on their Facebook feeds? And these campaigns are getting so good at tailoring their messages directly to individual voters that really by being able to spend time with them, you're seeing how different these political cultures and parties really are.
Right. So what are people saying in the 8th about the election? I mean, are they feeling very much under the microscope?
There is a lot of energy and a lot of interest. I don't know that it's because they think themselves are like, oh, we're in this competitive congressional district. Really?
Nobody talks like that.
Everything is about the top
no,
of the ticket.
I think they
it's
do talk about that.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, this is a primary. So we're seeing those voters. But I mean, I think for the Republicans that we've talked to, winning back the 8th feels very personal. Democrats feel like this is really new ground for them that they want to build on. And I mean, talk about, you know, last night when we were at this Republican candidate forum, really, I mean, everything comes back to one person.
Yeah, absolutely. There's energy on both sides, but we were at this 8th District candidate forum in Livingston County, and a voter there, Joe Farkas, kind of said it all. He's got three things he's really concerned about in terms of his top political issues.
Support President Trump. Support President Trump, and then finally, support President Trump.
Boy, pretty much says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, people do have their issues like healthcare and immigration and abortion rights or being opposed to abortion rights on both sides of the aisle that they care about, but it's sort of issues aside, is all about either reelecting President Trump or trying to beat President Trump.
Super interesting that voters on both sides are so Trump-focused this year.
Yeah, everything is about President Trump. And, you know, you're seeing, like Tyler said, this incredibly motivated, organized Republican base that is extremely enthusiastic. But what Democrats are hoping to do is the inverse of that. You saw them activate voters and recruit candidates in 2018 and have this blue wave as a response to President Trump. You know, we're talking with people, women who never even really got off the sidelines before, who are now candidates on a local level. They're hoping to be able to do the same thing. We talked with one guy, Kevin Church, and he was saying that for them, President Trump is also really the motivator.
They will be out. I mean, they were out in 2018 as well. And you're right. They will be out. I think they're fired up. Trump is going to get them fired up. But I think the key to our success is going to be women. I really, really do. The Democratic women, especially the ones that I hang out with here, they are fired up and ready to go. And the thing that Alyssa did was get a lot of independent and even Republican-leaning women to go to her side.
And that was in 2018, the most recent election that we've seen anything out of the 8th.
Right. And obviously Trump wasn't on the ballot when Slotkin was voted into office. I thought it was very interesting that Kevin said with Trump on the ballot, it'll actually, he thinks, help Democrats increase voter turnout because people want to beat this guy so bad.
I want to hear some more about this forum last night where the Republicans competing to take on Alyssa Slotkin got together. What did you hear? What was the energy in the room like?
So this was a big deal. This is Livingston County. This is a very, very, very conservative county. If you're going to win this GOP primary, you need these voters who were in the room last night, packed hall. And they are looking for three things. You heard about the support for President Trump. Two, they want to see an aggressive attack on Alyssa Slotkin. They want to feel like you can go after her hard on the national scene. And three, they're also really looking for somebody who can rally all this energy in the base. I talked with one woman, Sharon Lolio. She's a voter. And she was talking about this thing we hear a lot, this feeling among conservatives of being persecuted, whether it's by the media or, as they call them, like, you know, the leftists. They feel like just for supporting President Trump, they've got a target on their backs.
us being conservatives or Republicans, I think that we're made to feel like there's something wrong that we agree with a president that's putting people back to work and putting Americans first. You can't wear a hat? Sorry. I mean, I feel that this guy is doing a great job. I don't care what happened in the past with him. People want to go back years and years. I'm talking about the here and the now, and I'm very happy with Trump.
This is such an interesting district. I'm so glad you guys are doing this project. If folks are curious, they can see your coverage of the forum last night. It's up on the Michigan Radio website right now. And we've just heard the initial salvo from the podcast series so far. What other places are you guys excited about visiting in the weeks to come?
We're going to be everywhere, baby. We're going to spend a lot of time in Oakland County, like Tyler was talking about, because that's going to be a place where this battle is going to be fought pretty fiercely. Tyler's going to be in Ingham County tonight, right,
yeah,
with Alyssa Slotkin?
Later tonight at East Lansing High School, Slotkin's giving her State of the District speech, and it's a friendly area for the county, for her. Ingham County, very blue, but we also know that there are going to be organized counter-protesters. Maybe some of the people who were at the forum in Livingston County last night are going to be trekking up to Ingham County to be that ever-present group of hardcore anti-Slotkin pro-Trump supporters that seem to be at any time Slotkin makes any sort of a public address in the district. She's got that group of protesters there.
You guys, it's not even March yet.
Yeah.
It's going to be a long 2020 April.
Kate Wells and Tyler Scott are the reporting team behind The 8th. You can see, you've already got your first story from this Republican forum last night up. It's the8th.michiganradio.org, and the podcast sign-up will be happening later this summer. I highly, highly, highly recommend signing up for their Twitter feeds because they're already drizzling out those sweet nuggets of reporting as they go. Kate Louise Wells and Tyler, you're T. Scott on radio, right?
That's right.
Thank you so much for coming in, and thanks for your work on this.
Thanks,
thank
April.
You.
Tens of thousands of children have been detained by the U.S. government as the Trump administration continues its crackdown on border crossings. Families are not being separated at the border per se right now, but recent developments have laid a new impediment to reuniting families. The Detroit News reported this week that 19 immigrant children apprehended at the border and separated from their parents in Mexico have been sent to Michigan. Susan Reed is managing attorney for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, and we've invited her on to talk about these kids and the possibility of more expected. Susan, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much, April.
The Migrant Protection Protocol is the administration's policy that basically says that those seeking to enter the United States through the southern border should remain in Mexico. How is the MPP's current incarnation changing what's happening at the border?
Absolutely. It is an incredible departure from international law and practice that historically we haven't done the greatest job of following when it comes to the legal right that people have to seek asylum, both under international and our U.S. law, the Refugee Act of 1980. But essentially, people are taking the completely legal action of presenting themselves to seek asylum. And rather than being processed and admitted for due process to consider their cases, or as they certainly were in the previous administration, detained as family units, we are seeing people being returned to Mexico in an absolutely chaotic, I don't even want to call it a system, it's a non-system. People are being given fake court dates. People are being told that their court date is in the middle of the night. But essentially being told to return to these encampments at the border to await their hearing and case processing.
What's the age range we're talking about here?
Well, we're seeing, you know, a pretty wide range of ages, but 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds. You might recall that during the 2018 family separation crisis, we had a client who was 4 months old and separated at that age. Because these are de facto separations. These are kids who are returning to the border alone after having initially presented with their families. They're a little bit older than the very young children we saw brought to Michigan during the family separation crisis of 2018.
What would cause some of the families to consider
something like this, having kids try to cross the border alone from Mexico?
When we have talked to children and when we've been able to reach parents, people are describing a very complicated but ultimately difficult and dangerous environment in the encampments at the border. There are a lot of beautiful stories of resilience and people coming together, but ultimately it's a place where many families cannot provide for the physical safety and security of their kids. And so, you know, we have clients who were being threatened. We have clients who have been separated from their parents in the encampments and returned truly alone after losing family members, after family members have been kidnapped. And so while I think that asylum seekers are doing their very best to create a community in those encampments and survive, the children that we're seeing have been sent back to the border alone by their families because of a belief that they could not survive any longer in the camps.
Are there kids who you've worked with who maybe have language challenges beyond just not being very familiar with English? Maybe kids whose families don't speak Spanish as a first language, but instead speak indigenous languages?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge challenge of serving unaccompanied children, particularly children from Guatemala. We have access to Maya interpreters, which is an excellent service that is a telephonic interpretation line. And the foster care agencies have access to that as well. But, you know, using a telephonic interpreter is just not viable for the many daily activities for children. And so, release to family and family friends who speak their language becomes such a priority. But it's so difficult for a child to be in an environment where their first language is not spoken.
Are all the kids who are entering the system in this way released in Michigan?
No. In fact, very few of the kids who come into temporary foster care are ultimately released to family or friends in Michigan. Michigan has relatively small Central American communities compared to other places around the country. Kids come into the programs because the programs are part of the network that U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement maintains. Some kids are placed in other places around the country and then join family or friends in Michigan.
This cohort of kids who we're speaking of, the de facto family separations, as you put it, that have been coming since last October, do you know if any of them have been reunited with their families?
Well, some have certainly been released to family or friends in the U.S., but not, well, and I would say, and some may have taken voluntary departure to leave the U.S. to reunite with family who are no longer pursuing asylum. But again, it's just such a procedurally complicated issue when children who came to the border as part of intact family groups who could have been released to pursue their asylum case using an alternative to detention, like the very successful family case management system that had a 99% rate of success at having families appear for their court dates to pursue asylum. When we send that family away and they feel they have to send their child back to the border alone, now we have two parallel cases going on in immigration court to try to figure out a new case for the child and the old case for the family. It's just creating a tremendous procedural mess. And, our concern is about the welfare of these kids.
The Detroit News reporting mentioned the possibility that more children are expected to come to Michigan. What are you anticipating at this point?
Well, it's very hard to know what our government will do next to asylum seekers. It appears that the latest trend is to step away from the Remain in Mexico policy and begin returning people to countries that they traveled through. The U.S. has now what's sometimes called a safe third country agreement with Guatemala and has begun returning non-Guatemalans to Guatemala if they transited through Guatemala based on the farce that there's a functioning justice system, an asylum system that people could use to pursue safety in Guatemala. Similar agreements are happening with other Central American countries. And so it could be that this issue for asylum-seeking children and families will become more invisible because we won't see kids coming back to the border alone, or it's possible that MPP could ramp back up again. We just don't know, and we try to watch the trends and get the word out.
Some Americans look at the smaller number of people who are attempting to cross the U.S. border and feel that this isn't really an urgent problem anymore. Do you see that as being the case?
I don't see it as being the case. I think that numbers do not tell the stories of asylum seekers' lives. I think that anyone who had been in a vulnerable position, especially as a parent of young children, would not want to be seen as merely a number if they had to seek protection. And so we still think this issue is very urgent.
Susan Reed is managing attorney for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. After the break, we look into how the Democratic presidential candidates are doing in Michigan as we get closer to primary day. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you hold very still, you can feel it. The primary momentum is building. We've got questions about how the presidential contest is shaping up for Michigan and some things to talk about for how we talk to each other. For this week's news roundup, we welcome back Nancy Kaffer, columnist for the Detroit Free Press, and Bill Nowling with the Detroit office of the strategic communications firm Lambert. Nice to see your faces, you two.
Good morning.
It's nice to be here.
So here we are, post-Iowa. Post-New Hampshire, just on the cusp of Nevada, and still no one has a firm idea who the Democratic nominee is going to be for president of the United States. Are either of you gamblers?
So I have maybe a different take on this. I think it's fine that we don't know who the front runner is after two contests in very small, racially homogenous states. I think that, no offense to our colleagues in the national media, but for those of us who are in the media, we've been covering this race for like 2 years now with really nothing to actually talk about. And now that there are two contests out there, our brethren in the big leagues have seized on this like a lynx stalking an impala and are trying to wrest every little drop of meaning out of, again, two very small contests in racially homogenous states. So I think, you know, sure, sometimes people have come out of an Iowa and New Hampshire and gone on to be the nominee. Sometimes they haven't. And I think we're all just really desperate to know things, and they're not actually knowable yet.
Yeah, we haven't. I mean, there hasn't really been a contested convention in decades. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That's the process that was set up. You know, sometimes you go to a convention and it's not decided. I think the bigger news is that you can spend $500 million in 30 days and it doesn't matter in terms of you can deplete all of that effort in one bad performance at a debate, which is what Bloomberg did. And I thought that was, you know, interesting how they've ganged up on him as the person with the most money and, you know, welcomed him, so to speak, to the NFL. So.
Is it okay from the perspective of the candidates, though, where we are literally just weeks from go time for the Michigan primary, which is coming up March 10th, and there are some candidates like Joe Biden with relatively little going on in terms of presence in the state. They're having to spend their money in all these other places.
I mean, I think it's not just about them ganging up on him because he has money. I thought Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden kind of jumped in on this too, really strongly made the case for why some of the things in Mike Bloomberg's past are not compatible with the values that most Democratic voters like to feel they have. But yeah, I mean, your contention though that the one debate performance can undo all that money, do we know that more people saw the debate than are seeing his ads? Because my 9-year-old said to me yesterday, "Who's Mike Bloomberg?" I said, "How do you know about Mike Bloomberg?" He said, "I saw an ad on YouTube."
My kid says she says he keeps coming up in her feed too, which is crazy to me.
My child says, "They say Mike can get it done." Do they pay them to say that?
Yes.
Yes, buddy. They pay them to say that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think you're right. I mean, you know, most of the people didn't see the poll, but all of the media did. And so mm-hmm. the framing of the poll coming out of that is how horrible of a performance that Mike Bloomberg
did. And it was bad.
And it was bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was epically bad. And you know, so I think that that's what happens with these debates and participation in the early primaries. I mean, really only bad things can happen to you, and you don't really get a bump when this big.
I mean, I got to be honest. I don't know why he did the debate. He did not have anything to gain, and
nope.
he only had things. It seems like he would have been better to continue to float around spending lots of money on YouTube ads to get the 9-year-old vote. But,
Well, there's a new poll of Michigan voters from Quinnipiac University mm-hmm. that shows all of the top Democratic presidential candidates leading Donald Trump in head-to-head matchups in the state, albeit some of them were only leading within the margin of error. What do Democrats have to do to not mess things up and hold on to that lead here in Michigan?
So right now, you know, it's like Bozo the Democrat is beating Donald Trump. But and then when you look at most poll results, it's generic, the Democrat wins. And if it's someone who people kind of know who you are, like Joe Biden, they're winning by a little bit more. And if it's someone who doesn't have as much name recognition, they're winning by a little bit less. But that's a very much a primary position. And when we switch into the general election and it stops being so much about very insular intra-party contests and becomes a two-party contest, that's going to shift because we're going to have a lot more, whoever the nominee is, attacks on that person. There's going to be a lot more scrutiny, a lot more vetting in the media. It's all that's going to change. So these are promising, you know, right now, and people are really fired up, but that's not a guarantee that things are going to go.
Yeah, you know, I agree. I mean, you know, when you've got four choices of anybody against Donald Trump, you know, okay, I'm going to take a writer and pick one. When it's Bernie Sanders against Donald Trump, you know, I think that starts to work against Democrats in places like Macomb County and Kent County. But, you know, I think that remains to be seen.
We got to move on. M Live is following the lead of other newspapers in its parent company, Advance Publications, doing away with comments on articles in a contested election year. Are you guys going to miss this at all? Or is anyone going to miss this, I suppose, I should ask?
NPR killed comments a couple years ago.
That happened.
Yeah. I think NPR and MLive, when they reported that they were doing that, found that the vast majority of their comments were left by a very small number of their readers. And I don't know if MLive went into this in detail, but I remember very clearly from NPR's piece, they felt that because such a small percentage of readers were leaving comments, the vast majority, that it wasn't, not only was it not a true community conversation, it was actually distorting the community, the perception of what the community was, because it was
people from out of state would come in and jump in on a thread and go bananas.
And, but just disproport. It wasn't representative of what the vast majority of listeners or readers were thinking.
The purpose of those comments were to engage mm-hmm. the audience in the discussion of the news items, but that has never happened. It is just a shouting match that has nothing to do with the fact.
I remember a time when reporters for Advance Publications were told that they had to
yep.
engage with people in the comments.
There's been different trends in this. I mean, I've been around long enough to remember when we didn't have comments at all, and then there's been different waves of, you know, don't respond in the comments because that's punching down, and then do respond in the comments because we need to engage. And then now I think we're all like,
can we just forget this ever happened?
So the comments are dominated by a few very loud voices. They become abusive very quickly. I don't personally read the comments. Sorry, guys, if you're out there telling me that I'm a socialist.
Free press is still
witch.
Doing them.
It's a yeah. Well, but we did recently switch to a new comment platform, which has a better algorithm. It's the same platform used by Vox and the Washington Post, which is more easily can identify abusive or hateful comments and gives us a better ability to moderate. Because that's the other thing is you know, our resources are diminishing every year, and the ability to actually moderate comments is not something any newsroom has. So we're sort of reliant on, you know, you happen to click into the comments and see something awful, and then you report it, and we talk about whether we just don't have the resources to do it.
The real discussion on topics of the day from you know, from journalists and the reporting that goes on from news organizations is happening on social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and other places where people are engaging with their network of friends and family and connections and not on newspapers. So, I mean, in terms of that, you know, I'm less bothered by that as somehow that limits democracy because democracy has just moved on and is filling the void on the social media platform.
It absolutely feels like a lot of the energy has moved over to Facebook, not just in response to articles, but like actual news that's generated out of community discussions.
That's for us old people, though. The young people don't use Facebook. No. They're on Instagram and Snapchat and TikTok.
Mm. And so are the Chinese.
Finally, in Ingham County, a woman from Jackson was driving on Highway 127 this week. Do you see this? She goes under a bridge. A piece of concrete the size of a brick falls off the bridge, smashes into her windshield, and hits her in the head. Guys, about this road repair problem. Bill, I mean, is this a problem that's just going to keep getting worse and potentially lethal before it gets better? We've seen the problems with blown tires, but this feels next level.
It is next level. I mean, but it's also something that has been going on for years. I drive 96 into work, you know, and have for years. And before they replaced the bridge at Wixom, you know, they had plywood underneath it to keep stuff from falling on cars.
That's always a really inspiring sight when you see plywood tacked up to the bottom of an overpass.
Feel safe.
I mean, we've got bridges that are 50, 60, 70 years old and have not been replaced. And, you know, that's a problem. And, you know, some of it's going to be fixed with with the bonding, but not enough of it. Most of that's going to be on trunk line roads and not on, you know, overpasses and different things. And so, you know, you're going to continue to, if you don't do something about the roads, you're going to continue to have issues where the roads fall on cars or cars fall through the road.
That's the thing.
I mean, I don't know what more we can do. We know what the biggest problems in our states are. We need to fix our infrastructure. We need to put more money in our schools. We need regional transit in Southeast Michigan, and we're just not going to do them. I don't know what we can do to make this problem more clear. I don't know what we can do to rally more support behind it. I think, you know, in some ways, it's like we just want to cut off our nose to spite our face here. We just are going to. You know, and I get no one wants to pay more taxes.
Yeah, but numbers are numbers. You know, there was a graphic that was put out by the state Senate Fiscal Agency, and it showed the per capita median income in states around the Great Lakes. And Minnesota, which has one of the highest tax rates, has the highest by far median income of $70,000 median income. So there has to be. You know, it's not just that. You know, higher taxes depletes or works against economic development because in states like Minnesota, that's not the case. So, you know, I think we need to have a grown-up discussion about it.
We do, but we have one party that has been for decades selling the bill of goods that taxes are always wasted and evil and bad.
No, when,
you know, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, taxes are the price of admission to a civilized society. And we also have this sort of feeling that we've got all this stuff and nobody wants to pay any more for it. Like, well, but you have to maintain things, just like in your own home. You can't just let the roof sit there forever.
Is there a tipping point in Lansing, though, where, you know, a drumbeat of accidents and you know, just the average nuisance that the average driver in Michigan puts up with starts to tilt the conversation? Bill, you're shaking your head.
Bipartisan redistricting. That's what will change
you know,
the conversation.
I don't know if that's going to be the panacea that everyone thinks it's going to be. But even before, when the districts were better drawn and better representative of the population, these issues still were kicked down the road. So, you know, there's something more than just, you know, leveling out the playing field. I think that there's a perception that we don't need to change. There's a perception that, you know, what was good when I was growing up is good now. And it's, you know, and that's just not the reality. I mean, the economy, the world, the state is changing at an exponential rate compared to when I was young, and it's only going to get faster. And if we don't recognize that and start going back and changing our old formulas of doing it, we're not going to catch up.
Our roads are right there. We all drive on them. You don't need policy expertise. You don't need to sift through data. You just drive on them and you can tell how bad they are. And this is still not building a groundswell of support for fixing them. So, I mean, I don't know. It's just where do we go from here? It's not like people don't know.
Nancy Kaffer is a columnist for the Detroit Free Press, and Bill Nowling was with the Detroit office of Lambert. Both of you, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you.
I expect you to have solved the problems of the world by the next time we have you over.
We solve them every day. We solve them every day.
Like you, we can feel the minutes ticking down to happy hour. It is Friday, and Michigan Radio's Lester Graham is back with this toast for you in the latest installment of Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I'm Lester Graham with another episode of Cheers to Michigan, and you've got me in Grand Rapids. Where are we?
We're here with Nate Blurry, and Nate, why don't you tell us where we are?
We're upstairs in the Zeppelin Room at our Knickerbocker, part of the New Holland Distillery. I'd love to give you guys a tour real quick, then we can come back up here and make a cocktail or something.
That sounds great to me.
Fantastic.
New Holland makes its gins at this Grand Rapids Knickerbocker facility, while pretty much everything else is made in Holland. We got to peek at the stills, and we got to see their experimental bar where they come up with new cocktails, and the super secret gin lab. But it's the public spaces that are pretty amazing.
It is a very large facility. We have a massive capacity here that comes with three different bar areas distinctly. This is our main bar. And then out here we have a outdoor beer garden, and I'll walk you past that, as well as upstairs where our Zeppelin Band cocktail room is. And of course, we have our grand hall, which I just think is magnificent. And again, it pays homage to the local architecture, but also things of the area and these grand trees, 40-foot ceilings. It's really magnificent.
You know, because of this Cheers to Michigan radio series, I've had to visit a bar or two in Michigan, but I've never seen anything like this place. You should take a look at the pictures we've got online. Anyway, time to head back up to the Zeppelin Cocktail Lounge.
So what are you going to make for us today?
Well, today I'm going to be making the Suffering Bastard. It's sort of a tiki-era cocktail. It has both gin and bourbon in it, so it's sort of a little bit drier, and it should be really interesting to try.
But I see that's not a bottle of bourbon you have sitting there. That's a bottle of beer barrel rye. I don't even think I've heard of that. I've heard of your beer barrel bourbon.
We're really excited about our beer barrel rye. It follows the same process as our bourbon, but it came out about a year and a half ago. And the way we do this is a pretty cool relationship. We are a brewery as well as a distillery. So we make our rye, we pull it out and age our Dragon's Milk barrel aged stout in that barrel. Once the stout is bottled, we actually put the rye back in that barrel and age it for at least 90 days before we bottle it. So it's going to have a rounded, probably a little bit sweeter characteristic to it. And it's just something that's really an interesting symbiotic relationship, tying the fact that we are a brewery along with a distillery.
Yeah, as you were showing us, you guys are experimenting a lot down here. You've got a lab downstairs. You've got this boutique distillery that you're trying things out. Why is this such a big thing for New Holland?
We really do believe that craft cocktails and creating spirits is just as important as our beer process. It lends itself to allowing us to leverage our full portfolio and our capabilities. And we really just think it's fun to be able to tie, you know, spirits along with beers and bring people together at the same table.
So how'd you make this drink?
Well, it's real simple. I started with some ice in the shaker, and now I'm going to add an ounce of our beer barrel rye along with an ounce of our Knickerbocker gin and a couple of dashes of Angostura bitters and a half ounce of lime juice, and I'm going to shake it up here real quick. And once it's poured out and strained over a cocktail glass, I'm going to pour it into an original tin cup and finish it off with some ginger beer.
Great. Sounds good.
So one of the things astute listeners might notice from listening to that recipe is that there isn't any simple syrup or any kind of sweetening ingredient. And as you mentioned earlier, this is a drier kind of cocktail. The only sweetness is coming from that ginger beer. And I think that's where the name Suffering Bastard came from, because it was a little harsher of a drink.
It's very citrus forward, and it will be a stiffer drink, but I think you'll enjoy it.
Well, you know me. I love rye. I also really love gin, and this is a really nice combination of the two.
All right, I'm going to give it a little try, too. Let's see here. Oh, that's excellent. That's really good. And you can really pick up the gin, which I was afraid would get lost in it.
Well, I have to tell you, I didn't really feel very much like I was suffering when I drank that drink. So thanks very much for making that for us today, Nate.
Absolutely. Thanks. Cheers.
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 The dog may be man's best friend, but I am telling you, on the internet, cats rule. If you appreciate a good cat video, and who doesn't, you can see them on the big screen. Cat Video Fest 2020 is happening this weekend at the Detroit Institute of Art. And with that, play us out, Keyboard Cat. I'm April Bear. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.